the record. Mr. Carmody, I believe you were going to call, I think, what may be the last witness of the day.
Well, we've actually got three witnesses, but our goal is to complete everything by 5 o'clock. So
okay.
Most importantly, so Laura can get home and not be in trouble with her husband. Which
That's
is a concept that I understand all too well. we have three witnesses. I had said to we have a very short couple questions for Chris Irvin, who's the CCO for Department of Corrections on this. Mr. Morrison will handle those questions, and then we're going to have Mr. Morrison provide factual information to you. Even though he's an attorney, he will give you factual information because he's involved.
As a witness. Okay.
And that'll be a narrative presentation. Then we'll have Alan Fry, and that's what we have.
Okay. All right.
Okay. So we'll go with this.
You can state your name for the record.
Christopher Irvin.
And you swear to tell the truth under penalty of perjury under the laws of the state of Washington?
I do.
Thank you.
So good afternoon, Mr. Irvin. What's your occupation?
I'm a Community Corrections Officer 3 with the Washington State Department of Corrections Civil Commitment Unit.
And in terms of your official duties, do you have any involvement with the House on Viking Way?
I do.
And what
Ms.
is
Walston,
that?
I'm sorry, is the volume okay? Or if you could speak a little bit, I just want to make sure. Thank you.
Do you need me to repeat anything?
Don't think so, but I did interrupt you. I apologize.
Okay. In terms of your official duties, do you have any involvement with the home on Viking Way?
I do.
And what are your duties?
I'm the assigned CCO for one of the individuals residing at Viking Way. I have conducted a majority of the LRA investigations prior to all of the individuals moving there.
Is there a difference between the content of your investigations and ultimately what's in a court order as far as the conditions of the LRA?
Yes.
What's the difference?
I can't quantify that exactly. Each court order is individually written for each individual. So my investigations typically include very similar recommendations for conditions, but what ultimately makes it to the order is completely up to the individual court.
Okay. Did you have the opportunity to hear the testimony from the prior witness in this proceeding this afternoon?
Yes.
Do you believe you were the CCO that she was referring to when she called with her complaint?
Yes, I was.
Was there anything in the account that she provided that is inconsistent with your memory?
Yes.
How so?
She indicated that it took me 30 minutes before she called me back and was able to communicate with me. I actually called her back as soon as I confirmed with Mr. Frey that it was him on the property, possibly 2 or 3 or 4 minutes. I repeatedly called her back. She didn't answer the phone, so I texted her to let her know that I was trying to call her back.
Do you recall saying at some prior occasion, referring to LRAs as having supervision on steroids?
Yes.
What did you mean by that?
It's a description I typically use when people are asking me what is the difference between LRA supervision versus regular supervision, DOC supervision, probation, parole. It's one of the descriptives I use to explain that LRA supervision is significantly stronger much more than what would be considered regular supervision.
Did that refer to supervision by you as a CCO or supervision by WSS?
Supervision by me as a CCO.
Okay. Are you familiar with whether or not there are LRAs that are placed in adult family homes in Washington?
Yes. And yes, they are.
Are you aware of whether there's LRAs that are just placed in individual apartments?
Yes, and yes, there are.
And do those typically have the same conditions about pre-approval for outings and pre-approval for visitors?
Yes, they usually do.
And often requiring the same chaperone requirement?
Yes, they usually do.
Do you recall?
At least for a period of time. The individual is released to individual apartments, what we sometimes can call step-down LRAs or community-based, oftentimes have that restriction eventually lifted by the court.
There was some testimony about contact to potentially be approved as a visitor. If any of the neighbors wanted to have contact with these folks, could they ask you to be approved as a visitor?
Yes, they could.
is there often benefit to having pro-social support from community members and helping with an individual's transition?
Yes.
No other questions.
Mr. Carmody? Any cross-examination from either Ms.
I have a few questions, but I can go second.
Okay, Mr. Bolton.
Okay, thank you. So, Mr. Irvin, you indicated that you had called back Ms. Trujillo multiple times after the incident that she described?
I tried to call her back multiple times, yes.
Do you know what phone number you called?
I don't know it by memory.
I'm pretty sure it was her phone number?
It was the same number that she had been texting me from.
So I'm assuming that those phone calls would likely show on her phone in the call log.
Presumably, I haven't seen her call logs.
Okay. Would it surprise you that they're not present on her phone?
I haven't seen her call logs.
Okay. I just got a couple of questions for you. You indicated that it's not unusual for I'm assuming you're talking about sexually violent predators to be released on conditions on a conditional release under a less restrictive alternatives, that it's possible that they can be released to even, say, an apartment or their own residence.
Yes, it's possible.
Am I correct in understanding that?
It has happened, yes.
How often?
I don't have a way to quantify that.
How many are you familiar with?
Again, I don't have an exact number. I've been doing this for about
let me ask you
5 years,
okay.
Specifically in this position, and I've worked temporarily in this position for several years prior to that. So,
how is it that you know that this has happened? I'm kind of confused. I'm asking you which ones are you familiar with? You're saying you're not familiar with any, and yet you've indicated that you know that it has happened. How do you know that it's happened?
No, I'm not saying that I'm not familiar with any. I'm saying I don't have a way to quantify how many it's happened. I haven't sat down and counted them all out.
So you indicated that that when individuals do get released to, say, an apartment, you used an interesting term. You said that's like a step down LRA. Or a community-based LRA. So why don't we start with the step down? What does step down mean?
Typically, we have a couple of different terms we use in the vernacular. When we call it a step down, sometimes it's a step down from SCTF. That's the most common time that we use it. When we have a direct release to the community, sometimes we call it a community-based, sometimes we call it a step-down. Sometimes we call the step-down, or the release to the SCTF, a step-down. Usually a step-down refers to, it's a change of residence where there is less restrictions, where there are less restrictions than the previous residence.
So the SVPs that are present in the Viking Way facility here, none of those are what you would describe as a step down or community based.
I would describe them as a community based.
So they're like in an apartment?
No, they're not like in an apartment. I would call them in a community based because they're based in a community, not at an SCTF.
I was kind of confused. You were drawing a distinction between individuals who are placed or reside in an apartment, and you indicated they were different in a sense, that they were step-down LRA or community-based. So I'm trying to figure out, is that the same as what we're talking about here?
We use those terms for LRAs, including the ones at the Viking House. So I wasn't intending to use the term step down or community based to as a distinction between the LRAs and the Viking House versus people in an apartment. I apologize if that was confusing.
So would you say it's safe to say under RCW 7109 that what we're talking about in this facility on Viking Way, that this is transitional? The intent is this is transitional, correct?
All LRAs, the intent is transitional.
And the intent is that these sexually violent predators will transition to what?
That depends on what the court decides. That depends on how their transition goes and what progress they make.
They all have pretty much all have the same intent for what they're hopefully transitioning to, do they not?
So my intent is to supervise them according to their court order, to enforce the court order. So I'm not sure whose intent you're referring to.
Well, transition implies change. Would you say that's true?
Yes.
So I mean, is the goal to transition these folks back to the SCC?
I don't believe so, no.
So what would the goal be to transition them to?
And that depends on each individual and how much progress they're able to make. The goal is to transition out of the SCC. In some cases, individuals are eventually unconditionally released. In some cases, individuals have been under LRA for many, many years. It depends on whether or not they reach that point where the court deems that they either no longer meet criteria as a sexually violent predator or deems that that's when the court would deem them to be unconditionally released.
So that's a great segue. My next question for you is are the sexually violent predators who are present in the facility on Viking Way that we're talking about here, are these folks unconditionally released?
No, they're conditionally released.
Authority and supervision of the Department of Corrections?
Yes.
And there, it's safe to say they have a long list of conditions which, if violated, ultimately could take them back to the SEC.
Yes.
Can you tell me why they're conditionally released? Why aren't they unconditionally?
Sorry, could you rephrase the question? Or
what I would like to know is if you can explain why the individuals, these sexually violent predators who are present in the Viking Way facility, why were they not unconditionally released? Why were they only conditionally released?
I was not present at each individual trial, and so you would have to ask the courts. The courts are the ones who made those decisions.
Okay. What can you tell me what bare minimum requirement is for a sexually violent predator who is not unconditionally released, who is only conditionally released, when they're released into a transitional facility such as the Viking Way facility, what's the bare minimum requirement under 7109?
I believe the court can consider a less restrictive alternative placement, conditional release, once housing, if the right. There's, if I recall correctly, per the RCW, there's five. I can't recite them verbatim. I would have to have it in front of me. Housing has to exist. That is willing to provide housing to them and to provide the security necessary to protect the community, which is determined by the court. They have to have an SOTP provider. They have to be willing to abide by the court's conditions and be under supervision. And I can't remember off the top of my head the other two specific ones.
So with the requirement that there be security measures in place which are sufficient to protect the community, that implies that these guys are still dangerous. Would that be safe to say?
Yes.
So, but for pretty significant security measures, there's a high likelihood that these sexually violent predators would sexually reoffend.
I believe that's the determination, yes.
So one other question that I have for you is all of the sexually violent predators that are present in this facility wear a GPS monitoring bracelet?
Yes.
Or ankle bracelet?
Correct.
Can you describe, I recall, and I believe it was you, and if it wasn't, I'm going to apologize. If there were two of you guys from the Department of Corrections at the community meeting in Paulsville in the city hall there. And I think that it was you who described the accuracy of the GPS units. Is it possible to pinpoint these sexually violent predators' locations via their GPS unit?
It is possible to determine their general whereabouts and their general activity. Well, their general whereabouts. The accuracy of the GPS can be affected by many different things.
So it's my understanding that there is, and there's probably a scientific term for it, which I'm not familiar with, but you can only refine the accuracy to a point when you start getting false readings or false positives or that type of thing. Is that, am I correct in understanding
I
that?
Think what you're doing is crossing the topic of having a fixed point location or a home inclusion zone with accuracy. So those are two different things, but part of the same.
So I guess what I'm asking, is it possible for one of the sexually violent predators to, for instance, be in their neighbor's yard and you wouldn't necessarily know it? According to the GPS.
By the GPS data alone? Yes.
Is it miserable?
Can you just go over, so what happens if you get a report that one of the residents violated the conditions or have some indication that that has happened?
So if I receive information that there's a possible violation, if I get an allegation of a violation, if I get a concern, even just a question, I check it out. I investigate it.
And what does that include? Do you visit the property?
It completely depends on what the allegation is or what the concern is.
Okay.
I do visit the property almost on a regular basis, 3 to 4 to 5 times a month, more often if needed.
Okay. So for this property, do you have a say 3 to 4 times a month is okay. Sorry.
I frequently go to this property.
You frequently go to the property. Okay. Have you do you know if all of the residents, the 4 residents, are still on the property? Have any been transferred back to McNeil? Or?
Yes, one was recently returned back to SCC.
Okay. Do you know?
I do.
Can you share that, or is it?
It's part of an ongoing investigation. I'm not the assigned CCO writing the investigation report. I don't feel it would be appropriate for me to talk too much at length about it while it's still being investigated.
That's fine.
Mr. Morrison?
No more questions. Thank you.
Okay.
I have one
yes, Mr. Carmody.
The individual that was returned to SCC, the condition that was violated was not a sexual offense, was it?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Irvin. You are dismissed.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll next call Andrew Morrison. And again, this is factual testimony that he'll be providing, so he'll need to be sworn.
Okay. Mr. Morrison, if you could state your name for the record. Do you swear to tell the truth under penalty of perjury under the laws of the state of Washington?
Yes, I do.
Thank you.
So I am an attorney that's contracted by the Office of Public Defense to represent persons that are subject to the RCW 7109 civil commitment law. That includes practice and trial regarding whether an individual meets criteria, but relevant to today's hearing, I also have the responsibility of developing LRA plans for my clients. There are three kind of primary considerations in developing a plan, and in our state we're a bit unique in that the defense has to develop the plans. In every other state that has this, that would be usually a state agency that's doing it. I have to consider the best interests of my client to develop an LRA plan that would meet their best interests. I also need to make sure it's one that would get court approval, because it can't ever happen if it doesn't ultimately get that approval. And I also have to consider the individual's county of commitment. And so when I'm looking at a case, I'm considering all those three things to identify a particular placement. I personally have clients that are in a variety of different LRA placements. I have a client that is placed in an adult family home who is on an SVP LRA, and it's actually a Kitsap County Superior Court case that he is under. I am familiar with his conditions, and they do include requirements for the same sort of pre-approval process that Mr. DeVille has in his placement. And in his LRA and getting him placed in an adult family home, we did explore with residential care services with DSHS to make sure that the LRA was consistent with the adult family regulations and statutes. I've also got a client that's in his own duplex. It's in Lakewood. He doesn't have any staffing at all, no cameras. He has a chaperone that accompanies him when he's out in the community. And he has the same requirements of pre-approval for visitors and locations that apply to him. Each of these, incidentally, are all automatically designated secure facilities by virtue of having LRAs granted by a trial court. Even the individual that's in his own duplex that I think none of us would outwardly identify as a secure facility is automatically designated one under the operation of the statute, just as has occurred with Mr. DeVille's case. I was assigned to Mr. DeVille in July of 2015 to represent him in his civil commitment case. He is an individual with a mental age of 10.9 years old. His IQ is 68. His reading level is the third grade. In terms of how that translates to his day-to-day activities, he needs help counting change. He needs help with preparing meals that have more than three steps for the directions. Support with his communication skills, keeping a schedule. He is easily confused and easily overwhelmed. And this was best documented perhaps in his placement in 2011 at one of the SCTFs that's been discussed, the Secure Community Transition Facility, SCTF, that's operated by the state. He was in that placement for approximately a month before asking to go back to total confinement after becoming overwhelmed and deciding to quit because of the fact that the staff at the SCTF did not have any special training in working with folks with developmental disability. And so the needs that he has in terms of the ones I've described, they were not equipped to be helping him with. And so that attempt at an LRA did not work out, did not result in any sort of dysregulation or sexual type behavior. He quit and he gave up because he wasn't supported. When I received his case in 2015 and reviewed his file and the past record and assessed his developmental disability, I set out to develop an LRA for him that would meet his best interests, would get court approval, and would also answer the county of commitment requirements because he is a Kitsap County case. Within the few months of having his case, I first contacted Alan Fry, someone who is a stranger to me, but I had investigated to try and figure out who was working with developmentally disabled clients through the Developmental Disability Administration, or DDA, who had the reputation within their community of having a track record of doing a good job with this population, including individuals that have concerning offense history, really checking out within the community of providers with DDA that do this type of work, who has that reputation to have demonstrated this. That wasn't enough. That's what initiated the contact with Mr. Fry. And I described Mr. DeVille to him. It really was a process of almost 2 years of Mr. Fry becoming familiar with this type of client and ultimately meeting Mr. DeVille and being familiar with his developmental disabilities, where then I broached the idea with the Special Commitment Center of meeting with Mr. Fry to discuss forming a contract for supportive living services, explaining what it was with the special accommodating staff that could be provided, how that would work for Mr. DeVille. In March of 2017, the Special Commitment Center representatives and myself, and also counsel with the Attorney General's office that was acting on behalf of the Kitsap County Prosecutor's Office, we all went and met with Mr. Fry to specifically talk about beginning a placement such as this. In May of 2017, the Viking Way residence was identified, photographs and information circulated within that same chain discussing this proposal. ultimately, that led to me filing a petition for Mr. DeVille's release on LRA, which was the first petition for this house. And this is eventually how this placement came into being. That petition was filed in June of 2017. As outlined in some of the pleadings, procedurally in this case, what happened next is the state hired their own independent expert to evaluate the plan, Mr. DeVille's appropriateness for it, to again consider whether it was in his best interest, whether it's something that would be approved by the court, and whether it's something that satisfied the county of commitment requirements. That individual, independently retained, supported that placement. And so the Attorney General's office supported this placement. And in November of 2017, they sent notice to the prosecuting agency they were acting on behalf of, the Kitsap County Prosecutor's Office, letting them know that they intended to fully agree to this placement of Mr. DeVille's at this specific address, and inviting that Kitsap Prosecutor's Office to take the case back over if they felt a different course was necessary. That didn't occur. Ultimately, the court made its own separate determination in favor of this LRA, considering the evaluations before it and the investigations. December 2017 is when the court approved this LRA. Notice was then sent to the Kitsap County Sheriff's Department, which occurred prior to Mr. DeVille's ever releasing. January 2018 is when Mr. DeVille ultimately was released at the end of that month. He's been in his home for 16 months now without any issue from a community safety standpoint. This is a placement that was specifically developed in order to provide the accommodation for his disability. There are numerous different LRAs in our state that have varieties of staffing that are provided. Chaperone requirement is a typical one. The level of staffing that's provided here is not typical. This is my only case that has this level of staffing because this is my only LRA presently that has the level of developmental disability that calls for this staffing. It is a misunderstanding to think that the WSS staff are in place here because simply Mr. DeVille has got the SVP designation. These staff were specifically identified and vetted over a long period of time to accommodate his disabilities. The fact that Mr. DeVille has succeeded in his placement for 15 months when we had the issue before at the SETF, I think is the clearest evidence that it's exactly the staffing that has allowed him to succeed in his placement on LRA. Thank you.
Mr. Carmody, did you?
I don't have anything. Okay. I don't know if there's questions or not.
All right. Is there any cross-examination?
WSPSS cross-examination. First of all, I want to say that I recognize this is not a court. This is a hearing examiner. Mm-hmm. But I do think the same rules apply to a tribunal, and so I was a little surprised to hear Mr. Morrison testify. So I'm curious, Mr. Morrison, in what capacity are you testifying here today? Are you representing Mr. DeVille, or are you testifying as a witness in this proceeding?
Oh, well, with the testimony I just provided was factual. I have also appeared in this matter with the hearing examiner to offer argument. That is not how my testimony should be taken here. Hopefully it's been clear the posture change that what I was just relating is factual information that I have personal knowledge of.
Is this factual information based on your relationship, attorney-client relationship you've had with Mr. DeVille?
I have gained the knowledge that I'm talking about through the course of the representation with him, yes.
And so as I ask my questions in cross-examination concerning some of the LRA conditions, are you going to be asserting attorney-client privilege as I cross-examine you?
I think as you ask your questions, if there is an issue that gets into privileged communications, it's possible that could be invoked here, but I think it's a better course to proceed with your questions and there probably won't be an issue.
I raise the issue, Madam Hearing Examiner, because Mr. Morrison has testified quite extensively about LRAs kind of unexpectedly, and I think he's offering a lot of argument and fact. I mean, he's dressed up as facts, and I just don't want to drag this out any unnecessarily. I do intend to cross-examine him on a lot of what he just said, but the problem that I foresee is that much of what he just said is probably he's going to argue is protected by attorney-client when I start asking specifics. If it gets to that point, I might just ask the hearing examiner to strike his testimony.
Well, why don't we see what the questions sure. are and what the responses are, and if there's an issue, then we'll address that then.
So how is it that you're sitting here today representing Mr. DeVille? Is this on your contract with Office of Public Defense?
No, I'm here on a pro bono basis to represent this man.
Okay. So nobody's currently paying you to offer your testimony or to represent him?
That's correct. My time here is not part of my OPD contract.
But as part of your OPD contract, do you engage in the practice of drafting these LRA orders?
Yes.
So as I understand it, you testified here today that you are personally responsible for drafting these conditions. Is that correct?
I believe what my testimony was is I'm personally responsible for developing the petition. Ultimately, the conditions are set by the court, and I play a role in developing those and sometimes offering argument on them, but the court is the authority that ultimately sets those conditions.
So the petition you draft, what about the final order? Who's ultimately responsible for that?
I mean, in practical terms, myself and the prosecuting authority put together an order that meets the judge's rulings, so we draft it together.
So that's a joint practice of putting in the conditions, I mean the specific findings between you and the AGs, correct?
I'd say like in every case, the court expects us to put together an order that matches the court's rulings and we offer it for presentment. The rulings are made by the court. We draft findings to offer to the court just for purposes of entry to reflect what the court ordered.
And are these findings that are drafted in these orders, are they based off of the investigations that are done by, for example, DOC?
The investigations are often attached, but the findings are made by the court.
Mr. Morrison, please don't continue down that line. We know the findings are made by the court. The findings have to be based off of facts. What facts are the findings based off of? Is it based off of DOC's report? Is that part of it?
I'm just going to interpose an objection about argumentative questioning, if you can ask it in a normal
I understand how, I mean, courts
I understand
are.
He's frustrated with
the I understand how the court's findings are. I mean, it's based on input from the parties. Sometimes indeed, the findings will be drafted by the parties and the judge will sign off. But go ahead.
Correct. I think my question is, which is a fair one, is are the findings aren't made up by the judge, are the findings based off of the DOC report?
So
partly.
So it would depend on how the case came to that stage. Sometimes there's trials in which it's subject to the rules of evidence. A DOC investigation would never be admitted. It would have to be testimony in the trial. And in those cases, the judge makes findings of fact following the presentment of evidence in trial. In Mr. DeVille's case, we didn't do a trial because the Attorney General's office, acting on behalf of the Kitsap County Prosecutor's Office, agreed to the result. And so it was stipulated facts. So in terms of what the court was relying on, I think the best way to characterize in Mr. DeVille's case is stipulated facts between the parties. The investigation itself was not fully admitted, as if all that hearsay would become in the record. Hopefully
so
that clarifies.
The stipulated facts, for example, in the findings in Mr. DeVille's case, that there was adequate housing that protected the community, what were those facts based off of?
Well, and I think in the most technical legal sense was the stipulation between the parties. The prosecuting authority, again, acting on behalf of the Kitsap County Prosecutor's Office, agreed that from the evidence that had been considered by the experts in the case and documents I provided, that this housing was sufficiently secure.
Okay. And I, once again, then, can you be specific as to what facts that you think supported that stipulation, that the housing was secure? For example, let me be just more fair. Mm-hmm. At the time that Mr. DeVille's order was entered, had there been on-site security cameras installed?
No, I don't think so.
At the time Mr. DeVille's order was entered, was there a requirement by DOC or Mr. Frey to maintain on-site security cameras?
I don't recall. I do know that we ultimately, I think, delayed the day of release by a week or something in order to get the cameras set up. So that's what's telling me that they weren't in place at the time of the order.
So when there was a finding that was made that the housing was secure, for example, to protect the community, security cameras wasn't one of the factual things in existence at that time.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Okay. And then, like, for example, training, at the time that Mr. DeVille, the order was entered for Mr. DeVille, was there any facts to show that there was adequate training for the chaperones for security purposes?
So chaperones are not approved typically at the time of the order. The court sets out a requirement for chaperones, and there's a procedure for a transition team to approve them. I think the in terms of staffing and the qualifications of staffing that was considered, it was a focus more on the developmental disability and whether this met Mr. DeVille's best interest. The question of approval as a chaperone of the order, that was put off into the transition team would consider individual staff one by one.
And at the time that there was a determination made that there was adequate housing that would protect the community, did you, in drafting this order that you presented the court jointly with the AG, take into consideration the neighborhood and the character of the neighborhood?
Yes.
And what did you base that off of?
So there is an extensive body of research on to what extent residency restrictions should be considered, and it uniformly indicates that some of the sort of gut reactions of thinking, well, you ought to make sure that you're a set distance away from a school and that sort of thing, is not borne out by the research. So when I look at the community, I look to see, is this going to present an opportunity for Mr. DeVille to feel like he's living in a home? Because he is entitled to petition for that. There does need to be support staff with him to help with his kind of activities of daily living. But you may not think that a person that's labeled a sex offender deserves a place to live. I looked at this community and particularly this home to see if it would provide what I think he's entitled to petition for. And I did so knowing what the research tells us about what sort of considerations should be made when you're placing an individual. It may not match up with what the gut reaction is, but this has been extensively researched over the last 3 decades or so.
I understand, Mr. Morrison, that you may have looked at research supportive of a defense position on sexually violent predators, but I think my question is more directed to what kind of facts and investigation were done as to the character of this neighborhood in particular.
Well, I've visited the home and the location quite a few times before Mr. DeVille was ever released there. I've described a process of several years where we worked on this to make sure it was what would be appropriate.
So when you visited the home and the location, did you do an investigation, for example, into how many bus stops there were in the neighborhood?
No, I did not.
And as you were developing these facts, that finding, did you look to see how many churches were in the neighborhood?
I believe Department of Corrections looked into that. Not something that is related to risk of reoffense in the empirical literature. I did not look at that myself.
The risk potential activities that were addressed in this order come out of 7109, is that correct?
There were no risk potential activities addressed in the court order.
For Mr. DeVille?
I think risk potential activities is a term of art relating to the siting of SCTFs. That was not something that was within the scope of the LRA order. Maybe we might be misunderstanding what we're referring to.
So are you saying that then that in the order that you helped draft, that the court signed off, the court didn't take into consideration risk potential activities under Chapter 7109 before granting an LRA?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. The findings of fact and conclusions of law indicate what it is the court was best basing its decision on. And I think you're referencing a part of the statute that doesn't apply to this determination.
So when you're talking about a secure facility, your understanding is that it's not a requirement before the court grants an order that they look at those risk potential activities.
No, there's nothing in 7109 that indicates for a community LRA that there would need to be the type of review that's required for an SCTF to be cited.
And then you would agree, though, that under 7109, there's only two types of LRAs where the SVPs can be placed. One is a secure community transition facility, and the other is a secure facility. Is that correct?
No, I don't think that accurately characterizes things, because every LRA is a secure facility. As I've indicated, whether it's an individual's apartment or in a group home or an adult family home, the statute says if a court approves the release on LRA, it is a secure facility by definition. So parsing it to say there's only two types is a misnomer. There's only one type, it's LRA. Even SCTFs are a form of LRA.
An LRA is a condition, not a location, is that not right?
An LRA is the less restrictive alternative to total confinement.
So that would be a condition, correct? Not a place, it's not a location.
A placement, I think, is perhaps the best way to refer to it, and it does come along with conditions.
Now, when you spoke with Alan Frey during this initial investigation, did he ever indicate to you that the property at 1737 Viking Way was going to be used as an adult family home?
We didn't discuss operation of it as a licensed adult family home.
Did he ever tell you he had a license for WSS as an adult family
home? No, nor was one required.
And you're saying one wasn't required in order to obtain an LRA, is that correct?
Or to lawfully operate.
Well, I think that's an opinion on the ultimate issue, Mr. Morrison. I'm more concerned about the order here. Now, when you went through the process of drafting this order from Mr. DeVille, there were also findings that were made by the state, is that correct, concerning his possibility of reoffending?
All of the findings were agreed between the parties.
Okay, but they were based off of, I guess I should phrase it more clearly, they were based off of the psychiatrist reports, correct?
It would be helpful to me if you identified which findings in particular you're referencing, and I could tell you, I think, what we had in mind. So I think we all agreed that he is still subject to the SVP civil commitment, for instance. And that's by virtue of the fact that he was previously committed and has not petitioned for unconditional release.
Well, I'm looking at finding of fact number 2 on Mr. DeVille's order. It's page DCD page 6, or DCD 6 page 2. I don't know if we can pull that up.
DCD 6,
finding number 2 right there. One of the findings number 2 as we look at this exhibit was that he continues to meet the criteria of a sexually violent predator. So what is that criteria?
So finding of fact number 2 says that an annual review indicated he continued to meet those criteria. I'll then want to answer your question, but just to be clear, that's finding of fact number 2 wasn't a finding of fact that he met criteria. The criteria for being labeled a sexually violent predator is that you have a qualifying sexually violent offense, you have a mental abnormality or personality disorder that predisposes sexual offending, and it does so to a degree that makes it more likely than not that you commit a predatory act of sexual violence if not confined in a secure facility. Some of that's paraphrased. That's not the verbatim of the statute.
So. Okay, but I guess maybe I'm confused. Are you saying that on the date that this order was signed, Mr. DeVille did not meet the criteria of a sexually violent predator?
Well, strictly speaking, the LRA proceedings are not considering whether the person continues to meet SVP criteria or not. That question is not asked unless the person petitions for unconditional release. In terms of the findings, the court can't consider an LRA unless there's probable cause to believe the person can be served in an LRA. And we needed to document in finding of fact two that in fact there was an evaluation that said he was appropriate for release on LRA.
So by operation of law, though, he still does meet the definition of a sexually violent predator when this LRA order was entered.
Yes, he's still civilly committed as a sexually violent predator until he petitions for unconditional release and it gets granted. Of course, a lot of trial process. Just in legal terms, that's you remain committed as an SVP until that release ultimately happens.
And then to be more specific about what I was asking earlier, on page 4 of the same document that we're looking on, DCD 6, page 4. We're going to look at. Let's see.
I think it's finding 12 that starts page 4.
That's right. So the finding that the housing is sufficiently secure to protect the community as required by RCW 7109092, as I understand it, is based on the stipulation and that was reached between the parties. What other considerations did you guys present to the court in order to have that finding adopted?
Occasionally, the court has a colloquy with us. I don't recall if in this case Judge Dalton asked us further about that. It could be that it was presented as a stipulated finding and there wasn't further colloquy with the court on it. This was December 2017 when this was entered. That's the best I can do from my memory.
And then when we look at finding number 15, by signing this order, Mr. DeVille agrees to comply with any and all the supervision requirements imposed by DOC. So is it DOC that's sending the supervision requirements based on the finding you guys drafted?
I could speak at length about some of the vagaries of the statute. Mr. DeVille has to agree to comply with the supervision requirements imposed by DOC by virtue of that statute that's excerpted there. But ultimately, the statute makes clear that the conditions are set by the court. So what DOC offers are recommendations until the court ultimately makes a decision of what the conditions are. And I think probably by comparing the documents, you've seen that there's some differences between what DOC recommended and what Judge Dalton actually imposed as conditions. But in order for Mr. DeVille to be considered for LRA, he has to agree to be willing to follow any and all of those that are recommended by DOC.
And then, did you go over this order carefully with Mr. DeVille and talk to him about it?
Yes.
Did Mr. DeVille express any concerns or confusion about what his requirements were under this order?
Ultimately, I think you'll see there's a finding specifically with representation from the parties that Mr. DeVille understood the order. And so I do want to clarify in answering this. I think this was something that was expressly covered by this document as opposed to being privileged communications. I had to take extra effort. The document here was written at a reading level that was well beyond Mr. DeVille's comprehension, and it took us quite some time to go through this. And to the extent it was presented to him first off, he was confused, and we had to go through each item of it to make sure he understood. And the court wanted to make sure that process was undertaken as well.
Now, when you were going through this process of getting these orders presented to the court with your stipulated findings, did you contact the county, Department of Community Development, or anybody in the building department?
No.
Did you talk to any of the neighbors in the area?
No.
Did you talk to any realtors or do an appraiser about what maybe the impact this house would have on the community?
No.
Did you have any discussions with Mr. DeVille about applying for some sort of determination by the interim direct, or for a determination of, what's it called again? similar uses? Did you talk to Mr. DeVille about applying for a determination of similar uses?
No.
Now, does Mr. DeVille currently have a lease to stay at this house? Is there a lease agreement in place?
There is a requirement for a cost of contribution for his cost of care. I don't know what has been worked out on that. In terms of what you typically think of as like a lease agreement, I don't think there's one that's entered. But I believe he's signed program rules and there's some sort of contribution. So I'm trying to answer as completely as possible. With strict terms, I don't think there's a lease, but I think there's things in place that are similar to it.
Well, would it be fair to say that his connection to this house is purely the LRA order? There's no other document or agreement between him and the Calnans that allow him to be there, correct?
Yeah, I don't think it's with the Calnans. I think they have a arrangement with WSS, I believe. Mr. DeVille has an arrangement with WSS directly. That's independent of the LRA order because they've got program rules that he agrees to follow, and as I mentioned, that contribution or cost of care. I don't think it's correct to say that the only document that attaches him with the property would be the LRA order.
Are you basing it off of, well, strike that, you may not know. Now, when you're developing these LRA orders, and you said that the county became aware and decided to let, I guess, the AG's office handle this, were there some specific meetings or contacts with the county prosecutor's office?
My understanding is a letter was sent November 7, 2017, from the Attorney General's office to the Kitsap County prosecutor outlining the specifics of the LRA and where it was at procedurally, so that the county could intervene if they had concerns.
Well, at that time, had the residence at 1737 been identified as a location?
Yes.
Was that included in the letter?
I believe it was. It's been represented to me that, yes, the specific proposed LRA was indicated. I am not aware of any meetings. My impression is that letter was received and Kitsap County Prosecutor's Office took no action on it.
I have nothing further at this time.
Is there anything from Visipal? And Mr. Carmody, did you have?
No. But I do have a suggestion. I'll figure this out sooner or later.
That's why I always keep mine on. I don't trust myself.
I'm more worried about saying something stupid than I am saying something that someone doesn't hear. We have Alan Fry left. I don't see how that gets completed today. I know there are 5 o'clock cutoffs that staff has, and I kind of leaned across and talked to Laura a bit. But what
just
I would,
so we're concluded with Mr. Morrison. Just to
I'm sorry.
Okay, no, that's fine.
So my suggestion would be to continue this to to a mutually agreeable time. I don't know what your scheduling is here. In Kitsap County, I assume it's like 2 times a month or...
Yeah, I think Ms. Walston. I think the next available date is June 13. I don't believe anything's on that date. I'd like to hear from council, though, on... Continue, because we're at, what time is it? 4:38.
Yeah. And I think we have a... I understand there to be a fairly hard stop at 5.
Yeah, basically, you need to go at 5, yeah.
So, my thought...
I'm hoping to go at 5.
my understanding was staff had to go at 5.
Okay.
Is that incorrect, or...?
Let's cut off at 5. That might be...
Well, I have a two-pronged thought. Yeah. One would be just to come back on whatever it is, June 13th, mm-hmm. and go with Mr. Fry at that time.
And that's your last remaining witness?
I think it should be the last witness of the whole thing. Okay. And the other thing I would ask you to consider would be a site visit to the property.
We could
do both of those things at that time. Should have plenty of cushion.
And I was considering a site visit. I assume there's no objection to that from council.
There's no objection.
Okay.
No. I'd like to be heard regarding June 13th.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
So, my oldest son graduates, and I believe it's on June 13th.
Okay.
I have family coming in from a couple of different states.
That's fine. We won't do it on the 13th. So.
That's the worst excuse I've ever heard. But,
hey, your kids, you only go through these things once. So.
Hopefully.
I texted my wife, and she just responded, it's June 14th, but I still do have a lot of
people coming in.
And my guess is this, so if we started at 9, we have one last witness. I don't think any of this will take more than an hour. I mean, I think we are nearing the finish line on this.
Yeah.
So is June 13th still not, given that it's only going to be an hour?
I think, given the fact that I just got word from my wife that I was off by a day, I thought it was the 13th, okay. But it's the 14th. I can likely
make that work. Okay. All right. And Ms. Zippel, is that okay with you as well?
No, June 13th works.
Okay. All right. So we'll continue this to June 13th. I'll do a site visit either before then or that morning.
How do you want to do the site visit?
I'm sorry?
How do you want to do that? Do you want to be able to go up on the property because we'll need a coordinate? And there's
typically when I do site visits, I don't actually enter the property. I have done it before in a code enforcement setting, but that there was stuff on the property that I needed to, that made sense for me to at least have the context. I don't know that.
They're talking to see if.
And I presume the site visit's probably pretty standard, like any court. We're not take any other testimony or any comment?
No, I don't take any substantive testimony during a site visit, and typically I just drive by the site and I do not enter it. And so that's what kind of I was anticipating here to do.
It's this is an evidence. I visited yesterday. It is very, very difficult to do a drive-by and see it because cars literally are flying along. So it's a hard thing. It's not like you can kind of slowly go in front and look up. And the front of the house is blocked by large bushes for most of the.
So then is it all right to go up the driveway? Okay, yeah. So then I would just go up the driveway, turn around, and
okay.
So if there's a white car that does that in the near future, that would be me.
Okay, that sounds good.
So I think that addresses that question. Is there anything else we need to address procedurally today?
Do you? So I know in the past we've done various options about oral closing or written closing. I know you often prefer written, so just maybe in advance we could work that out so we know what to expect. And
what are the parties' preferences on that? Terms of closing, whether it's written, oral, or not at all?
I'm fine with either. Written would work better for me.
Sometimes it does help to have kind of a short, because I have all this, the evidentiary materials, but sometimes it is helpful to have short closing briefs.
So that was my question would mm-hmm. be is, what would the timing of?
Probably we would wait and establish it not today, but after. But on what 13th, I think. So okay. We just established the deadline.
So we wouldn't have closing due that day.
Oh no. Okay. It would come sometime after that works for everyone's schedules. To do it that way, and I may have some questions that might for the parties to address or on the 13th. So.
Okay.
All right. Is that it? Any other questions? Anything else procedurally we need to address before we reconvene on June 13th, 2019 at 9 a.m. in this exact same location?
I can't think of anything.
Okay. All right. We are adjourned. Thank you all. Thank you.